Last night on the front line, one of the subjects we covered was SUSE, this now universal student support Ireland business, where all applications for grants are processed in the one location. And I have to say, our texts and emails were absolutely swamping us. Such was the anger that people have. 66,000 applications, and only about 20,000 of them have been processed. 9,900 rejections, and the rest awarded or pending. But that leaves a further 45,000 or whatever in various categories, like not enough documentation and so on. And when you look at the simple sums, about 65 people processing and 66,000 applications, it's one person having to process 1,000 applications. So one way or the other, there would seem to have been built into SUSE an inherent delay. They are in front of the Oireachtas Committee on Education and Social Protection. So hopefully for all those parents who emailed and texted us last night, they will get some answers from the Dáil today. Anyway, that was last night on the front line. But last week on the front line, John Waters had the following to say about the possible motivation of parents who foster children.
That's a disservice. Minister, how much are they being paid?
John, that is a disservice to foster families out there.
How much?
You've quoted the amount, but
£325 for a child up to 12 and £353 for a child between 12 and 18. That's the reason. And that's the key, because that money goes at 18 anyway. That's why.
Can I clarify this?
Apply for adoption.
Well, strong reaction from the fostering community in the past week after John Waters highlighted what he saw as the financial benefits of fostering as a motivating factor for many would-be foster parents. Some took this to mean that they were in it solely for the money. Now, over the weekend, as a result of the children's referendum was becoming clear, Brian O'Connell travelled from Cork to Mayo, where he met some foster parents and children for whom the vote could have real significance. And he joins us now from our Cork studio. Brian, good morning.
Morning, Pat.
Now, tell us, first of all, Brian, how many persons are in foster care in Ireland and what kind of financial assistance is available to foster families?
Yeah, well, there's about 4,500 children in foster care in Ireland, Pat, and there are a variety of situations from short-term to longer-term care. You have public and private agencies working. As we heard there, the fees range from about 300 to 330 euros a week, depending on whether it's under 12 or the child is over 12. So I'd got in touch with a number of agencies, including the Five Rivers Agency, and they have an office in Cork and Dublin, and they put me in touch with the Healy family. And I arrived into the Healy household at 11 o'clock last Sunday, and the first thing I had to do was eat a fry, which Noreen had landed on the table in front of me. Jackie, the husband, had told me why he preferred the Examiner to the Irish Times, and we had a bit of a debate about that, and then we started our chat. So they started fostering about 10 years ago, and I suppose they had a baptism of fire, really, when the first girl came to them with a black background of abuse and neglect. And her case had involved several court cases, and the authorities weren't able to get the child to talk about what had happened to her or to detail the abuse. So I asked Noreen and her husband, Jackie, about the first night when this girl came to their house.
It was very exciting, but obviously it was daunting as well, because we were thinking of the child, how she's coming to a house where there's seven children already, and we were concerned for her as well, because she came from a big family herself, and we were thinking, how is she going to fit in here? How is she going to, you know, I don't know.
You find it emotional talking about her, obviously. How come?
Because when I got her story and what she had gone through at her age as a young child, no child should have had that experience. She should have been loved and cared for by her parents the way any child should be, and that didn't happen for her. So she definitely broke my heart when I saw what she had to go through when she told me her story. It was heart-wrenching stuff, really, for her. I have never taken a child in whose parents are unemployed or whatever. There have been very serious issues in the home, and that is the reason they come to our home.
And without going into the specifics of the case, with that child, I would imagine she would have talked to a lot of social workers, a lot of counsellors, psychologists,
yes,
over the years.
Yes.
And it took for her to earn your trust, for her, yes, to tell her story to ye.
Yes. It's we actually had, we travelled all over the country. We travelled to Dublin a few times. We travelled down to other parts of the country as well too. And it was Noreen's trust that won her over, and that she was able to tell her story.
So as you pointed out there, Brian, this was a person who'd come from a very, very difficult background, and it was the foster parents who in the end earned her trust, provided that shoulder to cry on, and they were there for the child when she needed someone.
Yeah, and I suppose the argument that a lot of foster parents put across to me was how do you put a price on that? I mean, Noreen and Jackie foster children, and some of them have come back to them every weekend, even though they are now young adults and are in college. One girl at the moment from Uganda who's 22 and an adult, she calls their house her home still. And it was interesting that Noreen and Jackie, they got into fostering first, having seen an advertisement in the paper, but they had always in their head wanted to go and volunteer in Africa. And as they said to me, Africa in a way came to them.
And Noreen and her family, they say that they benefited as a family from the fostering.
Yeah, I met their birth daughter, Eileen, and she said that, you know, as children, they could see the impact a stable, loving environment could have on children. And as Noreen and Jackie told me when they signed up, they didn't even discuss money with the agency. I think we'll hear a little bit from Jackie now, Noreen's husband, and he talks about the financial side of things.
I don't think that money ever comes into it like that. When you're dealing with a child, if a child tells you, dear, what has happened to her like that, you know, and you actually, you don't reach for a calculator to make up the money that she's going to, that you're going to make out of her like that. You actually have to listen to her naturally.
And it's only when you're in there doing it, actually, you take a step back and you'll say, yeah, you know what, it's working and it's well done. We are so proud of what we've done, and if two more come in tomorrow, I will give them a time, I'll give them whatever I can give them, and the day will come when I haven't got anything left to give them, that's the day I'll say I'm closing my doors.
And what about Africa then? Are you still going to go over to save Africa after this?
I think the girl, the foster child that I have,
Africa came to you basically.
It did actually. One of my friends said, I said, actually I'll never get a chance to go to Africa now, and she said, actually think about it, Africa came to you. She said, you have her. And that foster child now, she said, she's meant to get me out to her hometown to meet. I met her, I speak to her mum actually on the phone in Uganda. And the mum always thanks me for the great job I've done with her daughter when she goes back to see her. She said, I can't thank you enough. She said, you and your family, for what you've done for my young woman now. She's a fabulous girl. She really, really is.
Wonderful people there, Jackie and Noreen. Now, where else do you go, Brian?
I travelled to Mayo on Sunday afternoon, Pat, excuse me, and I met a lady there who's been fostering for about 28 years. She had told me she had accompanied a friend of hers 28 years ago to a fostering agency, and it was her friend who was interested in fostering, and the friend never went through with it in the end, and this lady ended up fostering. She reckons she's had about 40 children who have been through her home in that time, and currently she has two, a 22-year-old whom she has adopted and a 16-year-old as well. I asked her first, Pat, about the differences she's noticed between fostering back then and in the 1980s and today.
Cases coming through now are more abuse cases than those years. It was just more young mothers and neglect, but minor neglect in some ways, whereas today it would be more serious neglect and more abuse. And I have no regrets. I think at times I often said I kept my own family on the straight road because they saw all sorts coming into our house. And it wasn't just me. It was a whole family network.
The referendum result, the yes vote, would that have made any difference to you over the years? Were there times when there were children you'd like to have adopted, or they would have liked to have been adopted by you and yet they couldn't have?
Yes, I would have a child at the moment that would love to have been adopted, because I had an older child that was adopted, and she is 22, graduated from college. But I had a younger child that was very upset at the time that he couldn't be adopted. He's 16 now, so he'd probably maybe benefit by this referendum, hopefully. And what I get is $190 an hour, 24/7, to look after any child, any foster child I have in my care. That's what it works out to. So if John Waters can manage on $190 an hour and do a job as good as what we're doing for some of the children, I would appreciate if he would take up the offer himself.
Now, Brian, she mentioned that the referendum could have implications for one of the children that she's fostering currently, given that he's long-term foster care and may not now need the consent of his biological mother to be adopted. You actually spoke to the lad?
Yeah, I did. He's a great kid and very articulate, as we'll hear. I think we've been hearing a lot in the last couple of weeks, Pat, about what children may or may not need. And yet it struck me that we've heard actually very little from children themselves who are in these situations. Of course, I mean, there are certain sensitivities involved. But here is the 16-year-old now, and he has been in this house since he was a baby, and he's talking firstly about the result.
It was interesting to what my mum made a point that if it does pass, I could be able to ask my social worker about possibly adoption and that kind of thing. And I wasn't too sure what to make of it, but I thought it might be a good idea.
And that's something that you can't do now, obviously.
No, obviously. I need my birth mother's permission and that kind of thing. I'm not too sure how that would fare out.
Biological mum, then, would you have much contact, or how does that work out with your mum here?
Yeah, well, she was here only the other day, so whenever it suits her to come, or whenever she feels like she wants to visit, that kind of thing, she's always able to come, and there's never any stopping her or anything like that. You know, we're great to see her here and that kind of thing.
And would you talk to your mum about the circumstances kind of all those years ago, or do you not really go into that?
No, I haven't really mentioned it or anything like that. I haven't mentioned the idea of adoption or anything like that, because I'm not too sure how she'd take it or anything like that. So, no, I haven't really talked to her about that kind of thing, no.
And your dad, then, if he's still alive, do you have contact with him?
No, no contact at all. I'm not too sure what's the story there, so. Well, I was aware of this since I was very young. Anyways, I had always known. There was never an issue of having to tell me or talk to me or anything like that, because I had known from a very young age, right, yeah. I'd wonder, like, you know, what it'd be like if I hadn't been fostered, or if I hadn't came here and I was living with my mother now, how I would have turned out differently and that kind of thing.
And can you understand the reasons why in foster care, can you? Or?
Oh, I can, yeah. I mean, obviously, when there's a case like when there's a mental illness involved and that kind of thing, there's not a lot of choice in the situation. And I can understand perfectly why I'm in foster care, yeah. I mean, it was the best thing to do for me and that kind of thing, so.
It's very interesting.
Yeah, and one of the frustrating things that he talked about, Pat, were cutbacks and backup services. I mean, most foster parents I talked to welcomed the outcome of the referendum, but they all put in a caveat saying there needs to be the backup supports and services now. I mean, this person had talked to me about, I think we forget sometimes about, you know, when we're talking about impacts and frontline services, that how even small reorganisations, I think, can impact hugely on people's day-to-day lives.
Well, we can hear now, Brian, the kind of impact changes in social workers can have.
Well, yeah, no, the last few years we were without a social worker, and there was not a lot of controversy over that, because I had a social worker, a very good social worker, when I was younger, and she used to visit regularly, and she'd never miss an appointment or anything like that. And we lost her then, and for about 3 years we were on and off different social workers. Now, there was a period when we had another social worker, and she was very good, but she had been forced to leave. She was gone to a different department or something, another area or something like that. And again, we were back to the crack with having no social worker and having a social worker, and then them end up cancelling appointments and all that kind of thing, until we wrote letters to the Foster Association and that kind of thing. And eventually we got our old social worker back now, and we have her back, and she's still fantastic. She's the best we've had, so. The ones we had before that we were on and off, there was an awful lot of them that would end up cancelling appointments, and we wouldn't hear from them for months on end. And if there was a problem in the house or something like that, we'd have no one to go to, and we'd have no one to...
Sometimes were they your link to your biological family then? Was that how it worked? Or?
Well, yeah, basically. They'd say, get in contact with my mother, and they'd ask if they wanted access or for a visit or something like that. And they'd be chatting to them full time, and they'd be finding out how they're keeping on and how they're doing and all that kind of thing. So I'd be able to get information that I wouldn't get directly from my biological mother from them. So yeah, they were a great link between me and my mother.
And then, like you said, if people are changing every few weeks or every few months, you have to go through the whole process again, and it's like getting to know someone again.
I mean. Yeah, exactly. It's very frustrating now. I don't think it's fair at all, because mm-hmm. I have a right to a social worker and that kind of thing. So to have it abused like that and not acknowledged, it was awful frustrating.
That's very interesting, Brian. You know, there from the mouth of someone who is directly impacted, the client, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, he wrote to the Ombudsman, he was telling me afterwards, and that changed the situation. But I mean, he's a great kid. He really took hold of his situation, and he's very articulate, as you heard about it. And, it's worked out very well for him, really, I think. I thought as well, Pat, it'd be interesting to get the views of a family who've only been fostering for a couple of months. So this family I met have been fostering since July, and they'd prefer not to be named, but they took on a teenage girl in July for what was meant to be a night or two.
We have a 14-year-old girl at the moment, and she's from Cork City, and we're getting on great altogether with her. She's a brilliant child altogether. She's settled in well with the family and the children.
And you were saying to me that initially she was to come here for a couple of days, but that's now turned into 3 or 4 months.
That's right. At the beginning, we were told she'll only come for 2 nights, then it went to a week, then a month. So really, she didn't know whether she was staying. I mean, that child didn't know whether she was going to stay or move on to another family. In the end, we were told after about 3 months, yes, she will be staying with us. She's settled in. She's going to the local school and everything is great at the moment. There were 6 in my family. So I think my mum always had lots of people in the home, always looking after people. And I think that's where I really got it from.
Because it must break your heart when you see, like, some kids come to you here for respite as well. You were saying on short breaks. They might be as young as 10 or 11 years old and have been through a number of different houses.
That's right. That's very sad. They come to us maybe for a weekend, maybe for 10 days. Then they've got to go back and go on to another foster family. And even at that, those children would have come through maybe 2 or 3 foster families already. So that's very hard and very heartbreaking. And your heart goes out to that child. But while the child is in your care for the week or the 10 days, we give them a great time. We bring them to photo. Swimming, we do everything to make that time that you have with the child as most enjoyable as you can.
I don't believe that foster parents would be fostering just for the money. You're working 24 hours a day, seven days a week with the children. You're totally on call, and obviously, Mr. Waters never fostered, because if he'd fostered, he realised that you're not in it for the money, you're in it for the benefit that you can give to the child, and the benefit the child then can give back to your family.
Well, I know, Brian, you spoke to several other people and they all expressed strong views in relation to the positive benefits of fostering.
Yeah, for example, I talked to Teresa Connolly in Portlaoise, and she's been fostering, I think, for about 16 years. Now, the circumstances in her case were quite sad. A friend of hers was killed in a car crash, and she took in that friend's daughter, Sinead, who hadn't had much contact with her own father. And Sinead now considers Teresa's husband to be her father. And I spoke to an amazing young woman as well, Pat, Suzanne O'Brien, whom the Epic agency had put me in touch with. And again, she and her brother were put into residential care after her mum could no longer care for them. And, you know, she was talking to me about the differences between having been in residential care and then in foster care environment, and how it was just poles apart in terms of her experience and the impact it had in her life. And she also talked about how her opinion was never really taken into account, and that in her experience, her and her brother had been taken into care for a very good reason, and that the authorities, even though this is a decade ago, did everything they could to keep them together. So I suppose really from the people I talked to, the impression I got, I have to say, was of people who had a strong sense of civic duty deep down, and they were naturally caring and open people, Pat. I got very little hint that there was any type of financial opportunism involved in this. And as one of them said to me, if you're in it for the money, children will see through that straight away. You can't really fake family.
You can't fake family. All right. Brian O'Connell in Cork, thank you very much for a very interesting report. It's 19 minutes to 11.